But this was the logic of an adult worldview. Unfortunately, I could never get them to see how much pain it was causing their young daughter to be ignored in class, shunned by the other children, how this would lead to an emotional wound that might never heal. Ushikawa told her how Aomame was a leading softball player on teams in college and in a company, and how she was working as a very capable fitness instructor in a high-class sports club. Or rather, had been working until recently, he should have said. But he didn't insist on making the distinction.
"I'm very glad to hear that," the woman said.
She blushed slightly.
"I'm so relieved to hear that she grew up all right and is healthy and independent now."
"There was one thing, though, that I wasn't able to find out," Ushikawa said, a seemingly innocent smile rising to his lips.
"Do you think it was possible that Tango Kuwana and Miss Aomame had a close personal relationship?"
The woman teacher linked her fingers together and thought about this.
"That may have been possible, but I never saw it myself or heard about it. I find it hard to picture any child in that class ever being really friendly with Miss Aomame. Perhaps Tango did reach out to her. He was a very kind, responsible sort of boy. But even supposing it did happen, Miss Aomame wouldn't have opened up that easily. She was like an oyster stuck on a rock. It can't easily be pried open."
The teacher stopped for a moment and then added,
"It pains me to have to put it this way, but there was nothing I could do at the time. As I said before, I was inexperienced and not very effective."
"If Mr. Kuwana and Miss Aomame did have a close relationship, that would have caused quite a sensation in class, and you would have heard of it. Am I right?"
The teacher nodded.
"There was intolerance on both sides."
"It has been very helpful to be able to talk with you," Ushikawa said, thanking her.
"I hope what I've said about Miss Aomame won't become an obstacle in awarding the grant,"
the teacher said worriedly.
"As the teacher in charge of the class, I had ultimate responsibility for problems like that arising in the classroom. It wasn't the fault of either Tango or Miss Aomame."
Ushikawa shook his head.
"Please, don't worry about that. I'm merely checking the background behind a work of fiction. Religious issues, as I'm sure you know, can be very complicated. Mr. Kuwana is a major talent, and I know he will soon make a name for himself."
Hearing this, the teacher gave a satisfied smile. Something in her small eyes caught the sunlight and glistened, like a glacier on the faraway face of a mountain. "She is remembering Tango when he was a boy," Ushikawa surmised. "It was 20-some years ago, but for her it was like yesterday." As he waited near the main gate of the school for the bus back to Tsudanuma Station, Ushikawa thought about his own teachers in elementary school. Did they still remember him? Even if they did, it wouldn't make their eyes sparkle with a friendly glimmer. What he had verified was very close to his hypothesis. Tango was the top student in his class, and he was popular. Aomame had no friends and was ignored by everyone. There was little possibility that the two of them would have gotten close. They were simply too unalike. Plus, when she was in fifth grade, Aomame moved out of Ichikawa and went to another school. Any connection was severed then. If he had to list one thing they had in common in elementary school, it would be this. They had both unwillingly had to obey their parents. Their parents' goals might have been different, proselytizing and fee collection. But both Tango and Aomame were required to traipse all over town with their parents. In class, they were in totally different positions, yet both of them must have been equally lonely, searching desperately for something. Something that would accept them unconditionally and hold them close. Ushikawa could imagine their feelings. In a sense, these were feelings that he shared.
"Okay,"
Ushikawa said to himself. He was seated in an express train from Tsudanuma back to Tokyo, arms folded.
"Okay, now what?" I was able to find some connections between Tango and Aomame. Very interesting connections. Unfortunately, however, this doesn't prove anything. There's a tall stone wall towering in front of me. It has three doors, and I have to choose one. Each door is labeled. One says Tango, one says Aomame, and the third says the Dowager from Azabu. Aomame vanished, as they say, like smoke, without a trace. And the Azabu Willow House is locked up tight as a bank vault. Nothing I can do to get in. Which leaves only one door. It looks like I'll be sticking with Tango for the time being, Ushikawa decided. There's no other choice. A perfect example of the process of elimination. So perfect an example, it makes me want to print it up in a pamphlet and hand it out to people on the street. Hi, how are you? Check out the process of elimination. Tango, always the nice young man. Mathematician and novelist. Judo champion and teacher's pet. Right now, he's the only way to unravel this knotty tangle. The more I think about it, the less I seem to understand. Like my brain is a tub of tofu past its expiration date. So what about Tango? Did he see the whole picture here? Probably not. As far as Ushikawa could make out, Tango was doing things through trial and error, taking detours where he found the need. He must be confused himself, trying out various hypotheses. Still, he was a born mathematician, a master at fitting together the pieces of a puzzle. And he probably has a lot more pieces of the puzzle than I do. For the time being, I'll keep watch over Tango Kawana. I'm sure he'll lead me somewhere. If I get lucky, right to Aomame's hideout. Ushikawa was a master at sticking to somebody, like a remora to a shark. Once he made up his mind to latch on to someone, there was no way they could shake free of him. Once he had decided, Ushikawa closed his eyes and switched off his thinking process. Time to get a little shut-eye, he thought. It had been a rough day, given that he had to visit two elementary schools out in crummy old Chiba Prefecture, and listen to two female school teachers, a beautiful vice principal, and a teacher who walked like a crab. After that, you need to relax. Soon, his huge, misshapen head began to bob up and down in time to the movement of the train, like a life-sized sideshow doll that spit out unlucky fortunes. The train was crowded, but no one dared sit down beside him.
Chapter 11. Aomame. A serious shortage of both logic and kindness. On Tuesday morning, Aomame wrote a memo to Tamaru explaining how the man calling himself an NHK fee collector had come again, how he had banged on the door and yelled, insulting Aomame, or a person named Takai who lived there, berating her. The whole thing was too much, too bizarre. She needed to remain vigilant. Aomame placed the memo in an envelope, sealed it, and put it on the kitchen table. She wrote the initial T on the envelope. The men who delivered supplies would make sure it got to Tamaru. Just before 1 p.m., she went into her bedroom, locked the door, lay down in bed, and continued where she had left off with Proust. At 1 o'clock on the dot, the doorbell rang once. After a pause, the door was unlocked, and the supply team came inside. As always, they briskly resupplied the fridge, got the garbage together, and checked the supplies on the shelves. In 15 minutes, they had finished their appointed tasks, left the apartment, shut the door, and locked it from the outside. Then the doorbell rang once again as a signal. The same procedure as usual. Just to be on the safe side, Amame waited until the clock showed 1:30 before she came out of her bedroom and went to the kitchen. The memo to Tamaru was gone, replaced by a paper bag on the table with the name of a pharmacy printed on it. There was also a thick book Tamaru had gotten for her, the Women's Anatomical Encyclopedia. Inside the paper bag, there were three different home pregnancy tests. She opened the boxes one by one and read over the instructions comparing them. They were all the same. You could use the tests if your period was a week or more late. The tests were 95% accurate, but if they were positive, the instructions said, in other words, if they did show you were pregnant, then you should be examined by a medical specialist as soon as possible. You should not jump to conclusions. The tests indicated merely the possibility that one was pregnant. The test itself was simple. Just urinate into a clean container and then dip the indicator stick into it. Or, alternately, urinate directly onto the stick. Then wait a few minutes. If the color changes to blue, you're pregnant. If it doesn't change color, you're not. In one version, if two vertical lines appear in the little window, you're pregnant. One line, and you're not. The details might vary, but the principle was the same. The presence or absence of human chorionic gonadotropin in urine indicated whether or not you were pregnant. Human chorionic gonadotropin? Ah, Mama frowned. She had been a female for 30 years and had never once heard that term. All this time, some crazy substance was stimulating her sex glands? Ah-Mame opened up the Women's Anatomical Encyclopedia. Human chorionic gonadotropin is secreted during the early stages of pregnancy, the book said, and helps maintain the corpus luteum. The corpus luteum secretes progestogens and estrogen to preserve the inner lining of the womb and prevent menstruation. In this way, the placenta gradually takes form. In 7 to 9 weeks, once the placenta is complete, there is no more need for the corpus luteum, and the role of the human chorionic gonadotropin is over. In other words, this hormone was secreted from the time of implantation for 7 to 9 weeks. The timing was a little tricky in her case. One thing she could say was that if the test came back positive, she was without a doubt pregnant. If it was negative, then the conclusion wouldn't be so clear-cut. It was possible that she had passed the time when she was secreting the hormone. She didn't feel the need to urinate. She went to the fridge, took out a bottle of mineral water, and had 2 glasses. But she still didn't feel the need to go. Well, no need to rush it, she thought. She forgot about the pregnancy kits for a while and sat down on the sofa and concentrated on Proust. It was after 3 when she felt the need to urinate. She peed into a container she found and stuck the test strip in it. As she watched, the strip changed color until it was a vivid blue. A lovely shade of blue that would work well as the color of a car. A small blue convertible with a tan top. How great it would feel to drive along the coast in a car like that, racing through the summer breeze. But in the bathroom of an apartment in the middle of the city, in the deepening autumn, what this blue told her was the fact that she was pregnant. Or at least, that there was a 95% chance of it. Ah-Mama stood in front of the mirror and gazed at the thin strip of paper now blue. No matter how long she stared, the color wasn't about to change. Just to be sure, she tried another test. This one instructed you to urinate directly onto the tip of the stick. But since she wouldn't feel the need to pee for a while, she dipped the stick into the container of urine. Freshly collected urine. Pee directly on it or dip it in pee, what's the difference? You would get the same result. 2 vertical lines clearly appeared in the little plastic window. This, too, told Ah-Mame, she might be pregnant. Amame poured the urine into the toilet and flushed it down. She wrapped the test strip in a wad of tissue and threw it in the trash, and rinsed the container in the bath. She went to the kitchen and drank two more glasses of water. "Tomorrow I will try again and do the third test," she thought. "Three is a good number to stop at. Strike one, strike two." Waiting, with bated breath, for the final pitch. Amame boiled some water and made hot tea, sat down on the sofa, and continued reading Proust. She laid out some cheese biscuits on one of a set of matching plates and munched on them as she sipped her tea. A quiet afternoon, perfect for reading. Her eyes followed the printed words, but nothing stayed with her. She had to reread the same spot several times. She gave up, shut her eyes, and she was driving a blue convertible, the top down, speeding along the shore. The light breeze, fragrant with the smell of the sea, rustled her hair. A sign along the road had two vertical lines. These meant, "Warning, you may be pregnant." Amama sighed and tossed her book aside. She knew very well there was no need to try the third test. She could do it 100 times and the result would be the same. It would be a waste of time. My human chorionic gonadotropin would still maintain the same attitude toward my womb, keeping the corpus luteum intact, obstructing my period from coming, helping form the placenta. Face it, I'm pregnant. The human chorionic gonadotropin knows that. And so do I. I can feel it as a pinpoint in my lower abdomen. It's still tiny, nothing more than a hint of something. But eventually it will have a placenta and grow bigger. It will take nutrition from me and, in the dark, heavy liquid, grow steadily, unceasingly. This was the first time she had been pregnant. She was always a very careful person and only trusted what she could see with her own eyes. When she had sex, she made absolutely sure her partner used a condom. Even when she was drunk, she never failed to check. As she had told the dowager, ever since her first menstruation at age 10, she had never missed a period. Her periods were regular, never more than a day late. Her cramps were light. She merely bled for a few days, that was all. It never got in the way of her exercising or playing sports. She got her first period a few months after holding Tengo's hand in the elementary school classroom. Somehow, she felt that the two events were connected. The feel of Tengo's hand may have stirred something inside her. When she told her mother she got her period, her mother made a face, like it was one more burden to add to all the others she carried. "It's a little early," her mother commented. But that didn't bother Amame. It was her problem, not her mother's or anybody else's. She had stepped into a brand new world. And now she was pregnant. She thought about her eggs. Of my allotted 400 or so, one of them, near the middle of the bunch she imagined, went and got herself fertilized. Most likely on that September night, during the terrible storm. In a dark room when I murdered a man. When I stuck a sharp needle from the base of his neck into the lower part of his brain. But that man was completely different from the men I had killed before. He knew he was about to be murdered, and he wanted it to happen. I actually gave him what he wanted. Not as punishment, but more as an act of mercy. In exchange for which he gave me what I was seeking. An act of negotiation carried out in a deep, dark place. Very quietly, fertilization took place that night. I know it, she thought. With these hands I took a man's life. And almost simultaneously, a new life began inside me. Was this part of the transaction? Amame shut her eyes and stopped thinking. her head empty, something silently flowed inside. And before she knew it, she was praying. O Lord in heaven, may thy name be praised in utmost purity forever and ever, and may thy kingdom come to us. Please forgive our many sins, and bestow thy blessings upon our humble pathways. Amen. Why would a prayer come to my lips at a time like this? I don't believe in things like heaven or paradise or the Lord, yet the words are chiseled into my brain. Ever since I was 3 or 4 and didn't even know what they meant, I could recite this prayer from memory. If I made the slightest mistake, I got the back of my hand smacked with a ruler. Though you couldn't normally see it, when something happened, it would rise to the surface like a secret tattoo. What would my mother say if I told her I got pregnant without having had sex? She might see it as a terrible sacrilege against her faith. In any case, it was a kind of immaculate conception, though Ah Mama was certainly not a virgin. But still, or maybe her mother wouldn't be bothered to even deal with it, not even listen to her, because she sees me as a failure, someone who long ago had fallen from her world. Let me think about it in a different way, Ah Mama thought. I won't try to force an explanation on the inexplicable, but instead I'll examine the phenomenon from a different angle, as the riddle that it is. Am I seeing this pregnancy as something good, something to be welcomed, or as something unwelcome, something inappropriate? I can't reach a conclusion no matter how hard I think about it. I'm still in a state of shock. I'm mixed up, confused. In certain ways, I feel split in two, and understandably I'm having trouble swallowing this new reality. Yet Ah Mama also had to recognize that she was watching this little heat source with a positive sense of anticipation. She simply had to see what happened to this thing growing inside her. Obviously, she was anxious and scared. It might be more than she could imagine. It might be a hostile foreign entity that greedily devoured her from the inside. She could imagine all sorts of negative possibilities. But she was enthralled to a healthy curiosity. Like a sudden flash of light in the dark, a thought abruptly sprang to her mind. Maybe this is Tango's child inside my womb. Ah Mama frowned a bit and considered this. Why do I have to be pregnant with Tango's child? How about looking at it like this, she thought. On that chaotic night, when so much took place, some process was at work in this world, and Tango sent his semen into my womb. Somehow, through a gap in the thunder and rain, the darkness and the murder, a special kind of passageway opened, through some logic I can't understand. Just for an instant. And in that instant, we took advantage of the passageway. I took that opportunity to greedily accept Tango into me. I became pregnant. Egg 201. Or was it 202? Grabbed onto one of his millions of spermatozoa, a single sperm cell that was as healthy and clever and straightforward as the one who produced it. That's a pretty wild idea. It doesn't make any sense. I could try to explain it until I went hoarse and nobody would ever believe me. But the whole notion of me being pregnant itself doesn't make any sense. But remember, this is the year 1Q84. A strange world where anything can happen. What if this really is Tenko's child? She wondered. That morning, at the turnout on Metropolitan Expressway No. 3 through Tokyo, I didn't pull the trigger. I really went there and stuck the muzzle in my mouth, planning to die. I wasn't afraid of death because I was dying to save Tango. But some higher power acted on me and snatched me away from death. From far away, I heard a voice calling my name. Maybe it called me because I was pregnant? Was something trying to tell me of this new life inside me? Al-Mame recalled the dream, and the refined older woman who put her coat on her to cover her nakedness. She got out of her silver Mercedes and gave me her light, soft, eggshell-colored coat. She knew then that I was pregnant, and she gently protected me from people's stares, the cold wind, and other vicious things. This was a good sign. Amame's tight face relaxed. Her expression returned to normal. Someone is watching over me, protecting me, she believed. Even in this one Q84 world, I'm not alone. Probably. Amame took her now cold tea over to the window. She went out to the balcony and sank into the garden chair so no one could spot her, and gazed out through the gaps in the screen at the playground. She tried to think of Tango. For some reason, though, today her thoughts just wouldn't go to him. What she saw instead was the face of Ayumi Nakano. Ayumi was smiling cheerfully, a totally natural, unreserved smile. The two of them were at a restaurant seated across from each other drinking wine. They were both pretty drunk. The excellent burgundy in their blood gently coursed through their bodies, giving the world around them a faint purplish tinge. "But still," Ayumi said, "it seems to me that this world has a serious shortage of both logic and kindness." "Oh, well, no problem," Amama said. "The world's going to end before we know it." "Sounds like fun." "And the kingdom is going to come." "I can hardly wait," Ayumi said. Why did I talk about the kingdom then, I wonder? Amama found it odd. Why would I suddenly bring up a kingdom that I don't even believe in? And not long after that, Ayumi died. I think when I mentioned the kingdom, the mental image I had was different from the kingdom the witnesses believe in. Probably it was a more personal kind of kingdom, which is why the term could slip out so naturally. But what sort of kingdom do I believe in? What sort of kingdom do I think will appear after the world has been destroyed? She gently laid her hands on her stomach and listened carefully. No matter how hard she listened, she didn't hear a thing. Ayumi Nakano was cast off by this world. Her hands were tightly bound with cold handcuffs, and she was choked to death with a rope. And as far as Amame knew, the murderer had yet to be caught. An official autopsy was conducted. Then she was sewn back up, taken to a crematorium, and burned. The person known as Ayumi Nakano no longer existed in this world. Her flesh and her blood were lost forever. She only remained in the realm of documents and memory. No, maybe that's not entirely true. Maybe she was still alive and well in 1984, still grumbling that she wasn't allowed to carry a pistol, still sticking parking tickets under the wipers of illegally parked cars, still going around to high schools to teach girls about contraception. If he doesn't have on a condom, girls, then there shouldn't be any penetration. Amame desperately wanted to see Ayumi. If she could climb back up that emergency stairway on the Metropolitan Expressway No. 3 and return to the world of 1984, then maybe she would see her again. Maybe there Ayumi is still alive, and I'm not being chased by these Sakigake freaks. Maybe we could stop by that restaurant on Nogizaka again, and enjoy another glass of burgundy. Or perhaps climb back up that emergency stairway? Like rewinding a cassette tape, Amame retraced her thoughts. Why haven't I thought of that before? I tried to go down that emergency stairway again, but couldn't find the entrance. The stairway which should have been across from the SO billboard, had vanished. But maybe if I took it from the opposite direction, it would work out. Not climb down this stairway, but go up. Slip into that storage area under the expressway and go the opposite direction, back up to the Metropolitan Expressway number 3. Go back up the passage. Maybe that's the answer. Amame wanted to race out that very minute to Sanganjaya and see if it was possible. It might actually work out. Or maybe it wouldn't. But it was worth trying. Wear the same suit, the same high heels, and climb back up that spiderweb-infested stairway. But she suppressed the impulse. No. It won't work. I can't do that. It was because I came to the 1Q84 world that I was able to see Tengo again and to be pregnant with what is most likely his child. I have to see him one more time in this new world. I have to meet him again, face to face. I can't leave this world until that happens. Tamaru called her the following afternoon.
First, about the NHK fee collector, Tamaru began. I called the NHK business office and checked into it. The fee collector who covers the Koenji district said he had no memory of knocking on the door of apartment 303. He said he checked beforehand that there was a sticker on the door indicating that the fee was paid automatically from the account. Plus, he said there was a doorbell, so he wouldn't have knocked. He said that would only make his hand hurt. And on the day the fee collector was at your place, this man was making the rounds in another district. I don't think he's lying. He's a 15-year veteran, and he has a reputation as a very patient, courteous person.
Which means, Almame said, which means that there's a strong possibility that the fee collector who came to your place was a fake. Someone pretending to be from NHK. The person I talked to on the phone was concerned about this, too. The last thing they want are phony NHK collectors popping up. The person in charge asked to see me and get more details. As you can imagine, I turned him down. There was no actual harm done, and I don't want it to get all blown out of proportion. Maybe he was a mental patient, or someone who's after me. I don't think anyone pursuing you would act like that. It wouldn't do any good, and would actually put you on your guard. If the man was crazy, I wonder why he would choose this particular door. There are lots of other doors around. I'm always careful to make sure no light leaks out, and I'm very quiet. I always keep the curtains closed and never hang laundry outside to dry. But still, that guy picked this door to bang on. He knows I'm hiding inside here, or at least he insists he knows that, and he tries whatever he can to get me to open up.
Do you think he's going to come back?
I don't know, but if he's really serious about getting me to open up, I'm betting he'll keep coming back until I do.
And that unsettles you.
I wouldn't say it unsettles me exactly, Amama replied. I just don't like it.
I don't like it either. Not one little bit. But even if that phony collector comes back again, we can't call NHK or the police. And if you call me and I race over, he will probably have vanished by the time I get there.
I think I can handle it myself, Amama said. He can be as intimidating as he wants, but all I have to do is keep the door shut.
I'm sure he will use whatever means he can to intimidate you.
No doubt, Amama said. Tamaru cleared his throat for a moment and changed the subject.
Did you get the test kits all right?
It was positive, Amama said straight out.
A hit, in other words.
Exactly. I tried 2 tests, and the results were identical. There was silence, like a lithograph with no words carved on it yet.
No room for doubt?
Tamaru asked. I knew it from the start. The tests merely confirmed it. Tamaru silently rubbed the lithograph for a time with the pads of his fingers.
I have to ask a pretty forward question, he said. Do you plan to have the baby? Or are you going to deal with it?
I'm not going to deal with it.
Which means you will give birth.
If things go smoothly, the due date will be between June and July of next year. Tamaru did the math in his head.
Which means we will have to make some changes in our plans.
I'm sorry about that.
No need to apologize, Tamaru said. All women have the right to give birth. We have to protect that right as much as we can.
Sounds like a declaration of human rights, Almama said.
I'm asking this again just to make sure. But you have no idea who the father is?
Since June, I haven't had a sexual relationship with anyone.
So this is a kind of immaculate conception.
I imagine religious people would get upset if you put it that way.
If you do anything out of the ordinary, you can be sure someone, somewhere, will get upset,
Tamaru said.
But when you're dealing with the pregnancy, it's important to get a specialist to check you over. You can't just stay shut up in that room waiting it out.
Almama sighed. Let me stay here until the end of the year. I promise I won't be any trouble. Tamaru was silent for a while. Then he spoke.
You can stay there until the end of the year, like we promised. But once the new year comes, we have to move you to a less dangerous place, where you can easily get medical attention. You understand this, right?
I do, Almama said. She wasn't fully convinced, though. If I don't see Tengo, she thought, will I really be able to leave here?
I got a woman pregnant once, Tamaru said.
Almama didn't say anything for a time. You? But I thought you were...
Gay? I am. A card-carrying homosexual. I have always been that way, and I imagine I always will be.
But still you got a woman pregnant.
Everybody makes mistakes,
Tamaru said, with no hint of humor.
I don't want to go into the details, but it was when I was young. I did it once, but bang, a bullseye.
What happened to the woman?
I don't know, Tamaru said.
You don't know?
I know how she was up to her 6 month, but after that I have no idea.
If you get to the 6 month, abortion is not an option.
That's my understanding.
So there's a high possibility she had the baby, Almama said.
Most likely.
If she really did have the baby, don't you want to see it?
I'm not that interested,
Tamaru said without missing a beat.
That's not the kind of life I lead. What about you? Would you want to see your child?
Almama gave it some thought. I am someone whose parents threw her away when she was small, so it's hard for me to imagine what it would be like to have my own child. I have no good model to follow.
Still, you're going to be bringing that child into the world, into this violent, mixed-up world.
It's because I'm looking for love, Almama said. Not love between me and the child, though. I haven't reached that stage yet.
But the child is part of that love.
I think so, in one way or another.
But if things don't turn out like you expect, and that child isn't part of the love you're looking for, then he'll end up hurt. Just like the two of us.
It's possible, but I don't sense that will happen. Call it intuition.
I respect intuition, Tamaru said. But once the ego is born into this world, it has to shoulder morality. You would do well to remember that.
Who said that?
Wittgenstein.
I'll keep it in mind, Ah Mama said. If your child was born, how old would it be?
Tamaru did the math in his head.
17.
17.
Ah Mama imagined a 17-year-old boy or girl shouldering morality.
I'll let Madame know about this, Tamaru said. She has been wanting to talk with you directly. As I have said a number of times, however, from a security standpoint, I am none too happy about the idea. On a technical level, I'm taking all necessary precautions, but the telephone is still a risky means of communication.
Understood.
But she is very concerned about what has happened, and is worried about you.
I understand that, too, and I'm grateful for her concern.
It would be the smart thing to trust her and follow her advice. She is a very wise person.
Of course, Ah Mama said.
But apart from that, Ah Mama told herself, I need to hone my own mind and protect myself. The Dowager is certainly a very wise person, and she wields a considerable amount of power. But there are some things she has no way of knowing. I doubt she knows what principles the year 1Q84 is operating on. I mean, has she even noticed that there are two moons in the sky? After she hung up, Ah Mama lay on the sofa and dozed for a half hour. It was a short, deep sleep. She dreamed, but her dream was like a big, blank space. Inside that space, she was thinking about things. And she was writing, with invisible ink, in that pure white notebook. When she woke up, she had an indistinct, yet strangely clear image in her mind. I will give birth to this child. This little life will be safely born into the world. Like Tamaru had put it, as an unavoidable bearer of morality. She laid her palm on her abdomen and listened. She couldn't hear a thing. For now.
Chapter 12. Tengo. The rules of the world are loosening up. After he finished breakfast, Tengo took a shower. He washed his hair and shaved at the sink, then changed into the clothes he had washed and dried. He left the inn, bought the morning edition of the paper at a kiosk at the station, and went to a coffee shop nearby and had a cup of hot black coffee. There wasn't much of interest in the newspaper. At least as far as this particular morning's paper was concerned, the world was a dull, boring place. It felt like he was rereading a paper from a week ago, not today. Tengo folded up the paper and glanced at his watch. It was 9:30. Visiting hours at the sanatorium began at 10. It didn't take long to pack for the trip back home. He didn't have much luggage, just a few changes of clothes, toiletries, a few books, and a sheaf of manuscript paper. He stuffed it all inside his canvas shoulder bag. He slung the bag over his shoulder, paid his bill for the inn, and took a bus from the station to the sanatorium. It was the beginning of winter, and there were few people this morning heading to the beach. Tengo was the only one getting out at the stop in front of the sanatorium. At the reception desk, he wrote his name and the time in the visitor's log. A young nurse he had never seen before was stationed at the reception desk. Her arms and legs were terribly long and thin, and a smile played around the corners of her lips. She made him think of a kindly spider guiding people along the path through a forest. Usually it was Nurse Tamura, the middle-aged woman with glasses, who sat at the reception desk, but today she wasn't there. Tengo felt a bit relieved. He had been dreading any suggestive comments she might make because he had accompanied Kumi Adachi back to her apartment the night before. Nurse Omura, too, was nowhere to be seen. They might have been sucked into the earth without a trace, like the three witches in Macbeth. But that was impossible. Kumi Adachi was off duty today, but the other two nurses said they were working as usual. They must just be working somewhere else in the facility right now. Tengo went upstairs to his father's room, knocked lightly, twice, and opened the door. His father was lying on the bed, sleeping, as always. An IV tube came out of his arm, a catheter snaked out of his groin. There was no change from the day before. The window was closed, as were the curtains. The air in the room was heavy and stagnant. All sorts of smells were mixed together. A medicinal smell, the smell of the flowers in the vase, the breath of a sick person, the smell of excreta. All the smells that life brings with it. Even if the life force here was weak and his father was unconscious, metabolism went on unchanged. His father was still on this side of the Great Divide. Being alive, if you had to define it, meant emitting a variety of smells. The first thing Tengo did when he entered the sick room was go straight to the far wall, where he drew the curtains and flung open the window. It was a refreshing morning, and the room was in desperate need of fresh air. It was chilly outside, but not what you would call cold. Sunlight streamed in, and the curtain rustled in the sea breeze. A single seagull, legs tucked neatly underneath, caught a draft of wind and glided over the pine trees. A ragged line of sparrows sat on an electrical line, constantly switching positions like musical notes being rewritten. A crow with a large beak came to rest on top of a mercury vapor lamp, cautiously surveying his surroundings as he mulled over his next move. A few streaks of clouds floated off high in the sky, so high and far away that they were like abstract concepts unrelated to the affairs of man. With his back to the patient, Tengo gazed for a while at this scene outside. Things that are living and things that are not. Things that move and things that don't. What he saw out the window was the usual scenery. There was nothing new about it. The world has to move forward. Like a cheap alarm clock, it does a halfway decent job of fulfilling its assigned role. Tengo gazed blankly at the scenery, trying to postpone facing his father even by a moment, but he couldn't keep delaying forever. Finally, Tengo made up his mind, turned, and sat down on the stool next to the bed. His father was lying on his back, facing the ceiling, his eyes shut. The quilt that was tucked up to his neck was neat and undisturbed. His eyes were deeply sunken. It was like some piece was missing, and his eye sockets couldn't support his eyeballs, which had quietly caved in. Even if he were to open his eyes, what he would see would be like the world viewed from the bottom of a hole. "Father," Tengo began. His father didn't answer. The breeze blowing in the room suddenly stopped, and the curtains hung limply, like a worker in the midst of a task suddenly remembering something else he had to do. And then, after a while, as if gathering itself together, the wind began to blow again. "I'm going back to Tokyo today," Tengo said. "I can't stay here forever. I can't take any more time off from work. It's not much of a life, but I do have a life to get back to." There was a 2 to 3 day growth of whiskers on his father's cheeks. A nurse shaved him with an electric razor, but not every day. His whiskers were salt and pepper. He was only 64, but he looked much older, like someone had mistakenly fast-forwarded the film of his life. "You didn't wake up the whole time I was here. The doctor says your physical condition is still not so bad. The strange thing is, you're almost as healthy as you used to be." Tengo paused, letting the words sink in. "I don't know if you can hear what I'm saying or not. Even if the words are vibrating your eardrums, the circuit beyond that might be shot. Or maybe the words I speak are actually reaching you, but you're unable to respond. I don't really know. But I have been talking to you and reading to you on the assumption that you can hear me. Unless I assume that, there's no point in me speaking to you. And if I can't speak to you, then there's no point in me being here. I can't explain it well, but I'm sensing something tangible, as if the main points of what I'm saying are at least getting across." No response. "What I'm about to say may sound pretty stupid, but I'm going back to Tokyo today, and I don't know when I might be back here. So I'm just going to say what's on my mind. If you find it dumb, then just go ahead and laugh. If you can laugh, I mean. Tengo paused and observed his father's face. Again, there was no response. Your body is in a coma. You have lost consciousness and feeling, and you are being kept alive by life support machines. The doctor said you're like a living corpse, though he put it a bit more euphemistically. Medically speaking, that's what it probably is. But isn't that just a sham? I have the feeling your consciousness isn't lost at all. You have put your body in a coma, but your consciousness is off somewhere else, alive. I've felt that for a long time. It's just a feeling, though. Silence. I can understand if you think this is a crazy idea. If I told anybody else, they would say I was hallucinating. But I have to believe it's true. I think you lost all interest in this world. You were disappointed and discouraged, and lost interest in everything. So you abandoned your physical body. You went to a world apart, and you're living a different kind of life there, in a world that's inside you. Again, more silence. I took time off from my job, came to this town, rented a room at an inn, and have been coming here every day and talking to you, for almost 2 weeks now. But I wasn't just doing it to see how you were doing or to take care of you. I wanted to see where I came from, what sort of bloodline I have. None of that matters anymore. I am who I am, no matter who or what I'm connected with, or not connected with. Though I do know that you are the one who is my father. And that's fine. Is this what you call a reconciliation? I don't know. Maybe I just reconciled with myself. Tengo took a deep breath. He spoke in a softer tone. During the summer, you were still conscious. Your mind was muddled, but your consciousness was still functioning. At that time, I met a girl here, in this room. Again, after they took you to the examination room, she appeared. I think it must have been something like her alter ego. I came to this town again and have stayed here this long, because I've been hoping I could see her one more time. Honestly, that's why I came. Tengo sighed and brought his hands together on his lap. But she didn't come. What brought her here last time was a thing called an air chrysalis, a capsule she was encased in. It would take too long to explain the whole thing, but an air chrysalis is a product of the imagination, a fictitious object. But it's not fictitious anymore. The boundary between the real world and the imaginary one has grown obscure. There are two moons in the sky now. These two were brought over from the world of fiction. Tengo looked at his father's face. Could he follow what Tengo was saying? In that context, saying your consciousness has broken away from your body and is freely moving about some other world doesn't sound so far-fetched. It's like the rules that govern the world have begun to loosen up around us. As I said before, I have this strange sense that you are actually doing that. Like you have gone to my apartment in Koenji and are knocking on the door. You know what I mean? You announce you're an NHK fee collector, bang hard on the door, and yell out a threat in a loud voice. Just like you used to do all the time when we made the rounds in Ichikawa. He felt a change in the air pressure in the room. The window was open, but there was barely any sound coming in. There was just the occasional burst of chirping sparrows. There is a girl staying in my apartment in Tokyo. Not a girlfriend or anything. Something happened, and she's taking shelter there temporarily. A few days ago, she told me on the phone about an NHK collector who came by, how he knocked on the door, and what he did and said out in the corridor. It was strange how closely it resembled the methods you used to use. The words she heard were exactly the same lines I remember, the expressions I was hoping I could totally erase from my memory. And I'm thinking now that that fee collector might actually have been you. Am I wrong? Tengo waited 30 seconds. His father didn't twitch a single eyelash. There's just one thing I want, for you to never knock on my door again. I don't have a TV, and those days when we went around together collecting fees are long gone. I think we already agreed on that, that time in front of my teacher. I don't remember her name, the one who was in charge of my class. A short lady, with glasses. You remember that, right? So, don't knock on my door ever again, okay? And not just my place. Don't knock on any more doors anywhere. You're not an NHK fee collector anymore, and you don't have the right to scare people like that. Tengo stood up, went to the window, and looked outside. An old man in a bulky sweater, clutching a cane, was walking in front of the woods. He was probably just taking a stroll. He was tall, with white hair and excellent posture. But his steps were awkward, as if he had forgotten how to walk, as if with each step forward he was remembering how to do it. Tengo watched him for a while. The old man slowly made his way across the garden, then turned the corner of the building and disappeared. It didn't look like he had recalled the art of walking. Tengo turned to face his father.
"I'm not blaming you. You have the right to send your consciousness wherever you want. It's your life and your consciousness. You have your own idea of what is right, and you're putting it into practice. Maybe I don't have the right to say these things. But you need to understand. You are not an NHK fee collector anymore, so you shouldn't pretend to be one. It's pointless."
Tengo sat down on the windowsill and searched for his next words in the air of the cramped hospital room.
"I don't know what kind of life you had, what sorts of joys and sorrows you experienced. But even if there was something that left you unfulfilled, you can't go around seeking it at other people's doors, even if it is at the place you're most familiar with and the sort of act that is your forte."
Tengo gazed silently at his father's face.
"I don't want you to knock on anybody's door anymore. That's all I ask of you, Father. I have to be going. I came here every day talking to you in your coma, reading to you, and I think at least a part of us has reconciled, and I think that reconciliation has actually taken place in the real world. Maybe you won't like it, but you need to come back here again, to this side. This is where you belong."
Tengo lifted his shoulder bag and slung it across his shoulder.
"Well, I'll be off then."
His father said nothing. He didn't stir, and his eyes remained shut, the same as always. But somehow it seemed like he was thinking about something. Tengo was quiet and paid careful attention. It felt to him like his father might pop open his eyes at any moment and abruptly sit up in bed. But none of that happened. The nurse with the spidery limbs was still at the reception desk as he left. A plastic name tag on her chest said, "Tamaki."
"I'm going back to Tokyo now," Tengo told her.
"It's too bad your father didn't regain consciousness while you were here," she said consolingly. "But I'm sure he was happy you could stay so long."
Tengo couldn't think of a decent response.
"Please tell the other nurses goodbye for me. You have all been so helpful."
He never did see bespectacled Nurse Tamura or busty Nurse Omura and her ever-present ballpoint pen. It made him a little sad. They were outstanding nurses and had always been kind to him. But perhaps it was for the best that he didn't see them. After all, he was slipping out of the cat town alone. As the train pulled out of Chikura Station, he recalled spending the night at Kumi Adachi's apartment. It had only just happened yesterday. The gaudy Tiffany lamp, the uncomfortable love seat, the TV comedy show he could hear from next door, the hooting of the owl in the woods, the hashish smoke, the smiley face shirt, the thick pubic hair pressed against his leg. It had been less than a day, but it felt like long ago. His mind felt unstable, like an unbalanced set of scales. The core of his memories wouldn't settle down in one spot. Suddenly anxious, Tengo looked around him. Was this reality actually real, or had he once again boarded the wrong reality? He asked a passenger nearby and made sure this train was indeed headed to Tateyama.
It's okay. Don't worry, he told himself. At Tateyama, I can change to the